You're listening to CPC Together, a podcast produced by Central Peninsula Church in the San Francisco Bay Area. All right, Kevin, I want to start with a song that your sermon inspired. It's a song from my childhood. I found it. We're going to start a little bit. I don't know if we have to give cred to this. Or if we're
podcast will be taken down.
Flagged. I wish you could see the video right now, listeners.
Look at those collars.
So, Kevin, can you describe this video a little bit right now?
I don't know if I can. They're walking. It looks like on the other side of Highway 280 in the woods. They're walking in full suits, pure white.
70s.
With 70s suits with blistering red collars. And a sort of gleam and a sheen to them. You know what it sounds like? It sounds like,
it sounds like
an old school jingle, like for bubblegum.
Yeah. Double mint gum. Double your refreshment. You know what the best bubblegum jam, I thought? Juicy Fruit.
Juicy Fruit?
Juicy Fruit is gonna move ya. The taste will sound, get right through ya. Juicy Fruit, the taste is gonna move ya.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
I don't remember that one.
Oh, man.
I remember, what was the gum? I had like a giraffe.
Oh, Stripes.
Stripes, yes.
Zebra.
Was it Zebra?
Wasn't it Zebra?
I don't know. We got to look it up.
And it loses flavor like 5 seconds after
you unwrap it.
It turns all hard.
You have 2 seconds to chew it before you
lose
the
flavor. I think the gum is called Fruity Stripes or something.
Fruit Stripes?
I think it's a Zebra, but I can see why.
Fruit Stripes gum, Zebra. Fruit Stripe. Yeah, here it is.
Is it a Zebra?
Yeah. There is a Zebra on it. Yeah. The listeners are riveted. this is the stuff they tune in for.
Yeah.
our hot bubblegum takes.
But I am curious, what are some of the things, Kevin, that you go to? Let's say maybe in your past, you've moved on from all of needing to find happiness now because you've already found it. But what are some of the little things that you would run to find happiness? Because that was like kind of the main question of your whole sermon.
Yeah. Like what age bracket are we talking here?
Let's go.
I shouldn't have asked you that. I feel like you have my whole life in your
hands.
Let's
go 10-year-old Kevin.
10-year-old Kevin. Okay. Man, that would have been rollerblading years.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, yeah. I rollerbladed like crazy.
So was there a thing in your mind that if you had this one thing, like...
The K2 could... rollerblades.
K2?
Yeah. I just remember, I couldn't even tell you what they looked like. I just remember thinking that if I had those, Adam Kulhoff would have been blown away and I would have arrived.
Wait, who is Adam Kulhoff?
He was my childhood friend who I like.
Oh, okay.
I'd wake up and we'd put our rollerblades on like in the summer, like first thing, and wouldn't take them off till after dinner, man. And we would just cruise.
You just blade till the break of day.
Just blade till the break of day. That's got a good album title, man.
Yeah.
Blade until the break of day. We'd blade down. We'd race down to Woody's, which was this like convenience store. And there were two ways from our house to go. And they're more or less exactly the same distance. And so we'd always just race and we'd switch off which side we got to go.
Did you do like, did you ever do like grinding on rails?
No. We were pure inline. We were not that cool. Yeah. We thought we were cool, but we were not that cool.
So if you were to strap on some blades right now, how do you think, how would it go?
My guess is not well. I don't know if it'd go well. Or maybe it's like riding a bike, but I didn't ride bikes as a kid. I bladed.
I put on rollerblades for the first time, I remember, a couple of years ago. I don't even remember where.
For the first time?
For the first time in a long time.
Oh, man.
No, I bladed myself.
You're a soul skater?
I had a pair of Bowers.
Bowers, nice.
They were very nice.
Yeah.
They were given to me, but they were nice. And I couldn't believe how much this makes me feel so old. I'm going to believe how much my lower back hurt. Because essentially when you're rollerblading,
it's your whole core. It's everything. Yeah.
It's core the entire time. I never remember thinking, oh, my back hurts when I was rollerblading.
Yeah. I don't think it's possible for a kid's back to hurt.
Yeah.
I just think it's impossible.
Fall out of a tree and they're like, eh.
Yeah, it's fine. Just walk it off.
But meanwhile, like in your 30s, you sneeze. You're like... And you're like, oh, my lower back.
Oh, man. What made you happy at age 10?
Age 10, oh, man. Friends. I wish I had friends when I was 10. My parents moved me to Iowa. Check this out. Okay, so they move us to Iowa.
Bro, do you need a hug right now?
Yes.
So, what would have made me happy was friends.
What about
Herbalsheimer?
He was not a friend. Yeah. Someone came up to me and like really resonated with the Herbalsheimer story. I feel like I found my people.
You struck a nerve.
Yeah. I went to, so go to Iowa.
Yeah.
Total culture shock, especially back then.
Yeah.
Now it's not as big a deal.
Because you were from California before that. Okay.
But now because of the internet and all that kind of stuff.
It's not as drastic.
It's not as drastic.
Yeah.
But back then, like trends that were happening in California, they didn't have Iowa for like 5-10 years.
Like for you to have been current in Iowa from California trends, you would have stood out like a sore thumb.
Massively.
Like, who's this weird guy?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I was like Back to the Future or something. Yeah. But it wasn't cool at all. I was like, I was not a farm kid. I didn't grow up with everybody else. And here's like one of my first weeks of school.
Yeah.
I had my, you have the desks with the cavities, all this stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And I would just throw crap in there, a lot like my office looks right now. I would just throw stuff in my desk. And the way that this teacher dealt with stuff, all the kids knew this because they had heard of Mrs. Summy. Mrs. Summy.
That's good.
Which sounded like a nice name to me.
Yeah.
She saw my desk on a desk check day. And just dumped it out in front of the entire class. So I'm already this like kind of nerdy kid. Yeah. I just want a friend. And then she dumps my desk out.
Everything in front of everybody.
Oh my gosh. My mom got so mad at
Miss Summy. Man, that's brutal.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think if I ever got like embarrassed in front of class.
It's like a counseling session right now.
So Brandon, how did that like make you feel? Like when all of your insides were exposed.
Oh gosh. But the we carry this longing with us, like you said. We have we have a deep longing, and I thought it was really interesting. Taylor was his name?
Yeah, Charles Taylor.
Not a Christian, but a sociologist studying how humans relate, and he said something about fullness. What was it?
Yeah, so Charles Taylor, who not a Christian, but does he's probably Catholic, maybe in his personal life, but in his academic work, he kind of sets that aside, if you will. But he, in his, again, just monstrously important book, A Secular Age, which I don't know how many people actually need to read it. It's 800 pages. That's like just incredibly dense. And I fell asleep like 100 times trying to get through it. But in there, he makes this point, and this is in his introduction. And the whole book is really centered around this question of 500 years ago, belief in God was the default setting. You'd be born, you'd wake up, you'd believe in some sort of God, some sort of deity, whether it was the Christian God or not. Like that was just the givenness of reality. And he says in 500 years to where we are today, it's quite the opposite. The default setting is actually a sort of cynicism or a skepticism towards the divine, towards the transcendent. So he's just asking the question, like, how did that happen? Because that's a radical shift in the course of history that we'd come to that place. And so he's asking that kind of question and just saying, where did this kind of default setting get to?
Seems like it would be around advancement, like, right? Like,
a little bit.
We've achieved so much knowledge.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Especially with the information age now.
Yes, but it's a little bit, that's probably another podcast for another day. Because it's not quite that. It's not just science increases, belief decreases. It's actually way more complex than that.
Mm.
And his whole point, too, is that the transcendent has just more or less shifted. It's not so much, it's just that ache, that longing for God that 500 years ago was the default setting has now just shifted into other things.
Hmm.
And so it's, anyway, that'd be an interesting podcast, but I digress in the introduction. So this is the quote I use that talks about that, again, that ache that we all feel. He says, we all see our lives and or the space wherein we live our lives as having a certain moral, spiritual shape. Somewhere in some activity or condition lies a fullness, a richness. That is, in that place, activity or condition, life is fuller, richer, deeper, more worthwhile, more admirable, more what it should be. And he's, and what he's getting at, again, is this idea that to be human is to have that sort of longing, that that seeking for your fullness, your richness in life. And so he's queuing up that that's kind of the dilemma of the modern individual, is saying you have this ache, but now you can't, it doesn't naturally point back to God or the transcendent. And so what do you do with this sort of ache? And I think that's, again, the question I was posing on Sunday, is just all of us, to be human is to ask this question, like, where do I find my fullness? Where do I find my meaning?
Yeah.
And I think Advent in particular kind of attunes us more acutely to it. It helps draw out that ache in us. And Taylor is just kind of suggesting we all have that.
Yeah.
Believe it or not, we're searching for fullness.
It makes me think of a John Mayer song. I don't remember which album it's on, but it's called Something's Missing.
Okay.
I'm gonna read you,
I love John Mayer,
lyrics,
by the way.
John Mayer fan. So, you know, I mean,
did you see him when he was at Chase Center? Not too
yes.
long ago? You did?
Yeah.
Oh,
it was,
man,
incredible.
I was frustrated I didn't go to that show.
You should have gone. I wish I would have invited you.
Yeah. We
should have. Sorry, I didn't. But, you know, imagine John Mayer, you know, you achieve what almost every musician, songwriter, whatever, always dreams of achieving. You know, mm-hmm. he's got cool status. He's amazing.
Selling out Chase Center.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. He's
amazing
arrived.
Songwriter. He's an amazing guitar player. He's respected by musicians and by fans and all that kind of stuff. And he writes this song. I'm not alone, but I wish I was, because then I'd know I was down, because I couldn't find a friend around to love me like they do right now. I'm dizzy from the shopping mall. I search for joy, but I bought it all. It doesn't help the hunger pains and a thirst I'd have to drown first to ever satiate. Something's missing. I don't know how to fix it. And I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
It keeps going. He does this thing at the end. Friends? Check. Money? Check. Well slept? Check. Opposite sex? Check. Guitar? Check.
Yeah.
Microphone? Check. Messages waiting on me when I come home. That's an old reference. We used to have something called message machines. Yeah. And it just never, everything kind of falls short. Yeah.
That's like, and that's the perfect example, I think, of what Taylor gets at. Because what Taylor will call, so he says we're trapped in what he says is the imminent frame, right? And he's talking about imminence versus transcendence. So transcendence being that which is beyond kind of what's available to you immediately in your senses. And he says what the secular age has done is it's diminished the transcendent, and so you're trapped in this imminent frame. And so when John Mayer is searching for meaning, he's looking in the imminent frame, right? He says, I've got the wealth, I've got the career, I've got, you know, people waiting for me, I've got all this. He says, but everything is still leaving an ache that something's missing. I wish I'd have thought of that song for my sermon. That'd have been a great intro. But it's like that is what it is to be human, is we sense in the modern age that we're trapped into the imminent, but we're created for the transcendent.
Mm.
But because we don't have the imagination or the faith, if you will, for the transcendent, we keep searching for it in the imminent.
Yeah.
And without any kind of tools or ability to reach out beyond that, he says we're in this perpetual ache. And actually, I think I often go to pop culture because songs like that, movies.
Yeah. They'll tell you about
always,
the ache.
Yeah, they tell you about the ache most clearly. And all of them long for the transcendent. It's that, I've used this before in a sermon. It's Julian Barnes, who's this kind of preeminent atheist, and not like he's not one of the angry atheists like a Christopher Hitchens, but just he's an atheist writer. And in his memoir, he says, I don't believe in God, but I miss him.
Mm.
And I think that's like a perfect line that describes that kind of secular ache of like, I don't believe in him, but there's something in me that misses him. You know what I mean? Because he knows that. He feels that kind of ache.
Yeah, this is actually almost akin to what a lot of psychologists would refer to as nurture. Mm. Like we search for, I think I may have told you about this experiment that they did on nurture with little baby monkeys. It's the saddest experiment. Did I tell you about that?
Yeah, I think so. It sounds
familiar. Baby monkeys, they put, you know, they put you in a cage because, you know, where the baby monkeys are designed to go to like a another mommy monkey to help them feel safe.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so they wanted to see if they would, what they would do if they didn't, if, you know, they didn't have a, a mom in the cage and see what they would run to. So one monkey had its mom in the cage and then they would scare it and it would run and hug its mom.
Yeah.
So sad. Poor little monkey. And another one, they would have like a stuffed monkey that would make like monkey noises, maybe even be a little bit warm, but it wasn't alive. And they wanted to see if the, the monkey would still run to it.
Yeah.
And the other one was just a cold wire, like statue of a monkey.
Yeah. Yeah. Just and they
would,
like it.
The two other monkeys, even though it wasn't an alive mother, they would still run to this inanimate object. They would run to whatever was perceived as nurturing.
Yeah.
And I feel like there's an element that we maybe even develop when we're young, not to get all psychological because I'm not a psychologist, but when we're young, we kind of like, we find these things that make us feel a little bit more full.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we do that with food. Food has a very consistent, like, chemical nurturing response. Yeah. You know, that's why so many people sometimes get into drugs and then dependency. And I just feel like it on a larger scale, when you look at this, you can see that there's a hole in our heart in that. And we were designed for something more.
And so we keep running to like a facade, right? A parody of what ultimately will nurture us, will satisfy that kind of ache and that longing. And that's kind of, I think, the paradox of our faith is that so often we have to, you know, as Jesus says, like, if you want to follow me, you have to die to yourself. There's a sense in which you have to let that ache kind of not consume you, but the malformed aches within us that seek whatever it is, like those monkeys, whatever it is that appears consoling, they run to it. Like that's, and that's the human condition. That's Adam and Eve again in the garden. Mm-hmm. They're looking at the tree and saying, man, I know God has my best interest because he, look at what he gave us. But what if he's wrong? Right? Like, what if he really doesn't want have my best interest? I better go and make sure of that. And so they seize that autonomy, they seize that control. And then again, the devastation just continues to unravel.
And what do you call that, misdirected longing or something?
I call it like a malformed longing.
Malformed longing.
Yeah, I just made that up. So
that's good.
It sounds smart, though, doesn't it?
That should be your first book to put you in the celebrity pastor category.
A lot of people line up to buy The Malformed Ache. How life is miserable and you can find Jesus.
Yeah. Dr. Kevin Snead talks about. So you go into this whole thing about the passage in Psalms where it talks about, you know, blessed is the person.
Yeah.
I just real quick, I wanted you to go into that a bit and maybe in the context of defining blessing again for us, because I think, at least for me, I don't want to speak for our thousands of listeners, but at least for me, blessing, the word blessing has really been hijacked by a lot of different things. A lot of different things, even within like Christian pop culture. So like when I hear blessing, you know, sometimes I hear, you know, like prosperity gospel kind of stuff, like, you know, God's going to make you rich, or he's going to give you stuff, or going to give you all the things you want if you pray the right way, or whatever it is. But can you, you defined it a little bit differently, and I was kind of surprised by that.
Yeah, so in, you know, the word in Hebrew is the word asher, and it has this idea of again, blessedness or happiness, and so I don't think, you know, I think we can have a tendency in Christian circles to be really down on this idea of happiness, which is odd, and I think we could, it's okay to be happy, like again, because what is I think so profound here is we lump this idea of blessedness. Which is a proper translation of this word, but happiness is also a very proper translation of this word. Like that's not second rate or anything like that. But I think we tend to equate blessedness with this idea of kind of material blessing, and and it almost comes again some sort of like a prosperity type thing where it's like we to be blessed must mean that God gives us, you know, all the material blessings that we could have. But there's a difference in, and particularly in Psalm 1, where the blessedness, the happiness, is more the shape of a life. It's like a character well formed within you. It's not a instantaneous kind of external, circumstantially bound thing, but rather it's the whole of the trajectory of my life, the shape and form in which my life is taking, is one that can kind of weather differences in or different seasons or whatnot. And so it's a radically different kind of idea of happiness than I think a modern kind of understanding is. And I think that's why we have so much baggage on this word happy. I don't know why we as Christians have that baggage, other than I think we assume kind of what how the world around us would define happiness and just say, oh, well, we're different. We don't have that. So I think it's a good impulse. But God still wants us to be happy. Like, I don't think it's, he doesn't want us to be happy, but he recognizes it, as I brought out in the sermon, as a byproduct, not something you can achieve by direct effort. Because to pursue happiness by direct effort is really to pursue yourself.
Right. And I think that's the way, God. That's the reason we're down on it.
Yeah,
the way I was always, I grew up, you know, my dad was always telling me the difference between happy and
joy.
And joy.
Yeah.
You know, and I remember coming to him once and so frustrated with his response, because I was like, Dad, I'm just not happy with blah, 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 whatever it is. And he was like, well, you know, Brandon, this is a pastor voice. I always make fun of his pastor voice. Brandon, it's not about happiness. It's about holiness. And I was like, Dad, that is not helpful right now.
But yeah, I mean, I want to hear.
I think the assumption, or maybe the jump we make when we think happy, is that we're pursuing our own, the happiness of our own ego.
Yeah. It's a more like almost emotive kind of word. We think of it rooted in like smiling and cheeriness.
Yeah.
And that's just not, that's not the case. I think, and I think we can see it play out in the cliches that we well-intentioned hear or say in moments of tragedy, where it's like, well, be happy. God's going to work it out for the good. Like, there's a sense in which I think our culture doesn't know how to mourn. It doesn't know how to lament. And I know we've talked about that on this podcast a fair amount. But I wonder what it is in kind of the American consciousness that rejects the idea of sadness, like that it's just utterly wrong.
I don't.
You, as a songwriter.
I love sadness, man. I run to sadness. I force my wife to listen to sad songs.
Yeah.
Like, listen, this one's going to rip you apart. You aren't going to be able to walk after this song.
What's the first sad song that comes to mind?
There's this...
Or sad musician. Like, is there a musician that just... Like, well, do you remember...
Sufjan Stevens is...
I was gonna say Bon Iver, but Sufjan is up there too.
Sufjan is like, he's not even sad. He's depressing. You know, like, he'll sell like stories about
his
like
Christmas album. Have you listened to it? Songs for Christmas? It's really good. Yeah, he's got some old hymns that he rewrites. It's very good.
No, my sad songs are like 90s country, cheesy. Like, there's a song called If You Get There Before I Do, Don't Wait Up On Me. You know, and it's about this couple, and you know, that's how they fell in love.
Yeah.
You know, if you get to the tree before I do, don't wait. You know, I'll get you. I'll meet you when my chores are through.
Yeah.
And then he writes this letter to his wife who passes away, if you get there before I do. Oh, yeah.
Oh, gosh.
Or there's another one, How Can I Help You to Say Goodbye, where he talks to his little, this mom is talking to her little girl, and they're moving away from her friend. How can I help you to say goodbye? And then the end of the song, when she's dying, the mom says, How can I help you to say goodbye? And you're like, oh, my gosh.
That's so sad.
But I love it.
Well, it's honestly, like, what came to mind is I loved the movie Inside Out. That picks up because it recognizes this, right? Like, and that's as you watch, I forget the little girl's name, but as she's kind of coming to age, if you will, as her like brain is developing in a way where she's getting some emotional sort of like complexity, and she recognizes like those core memories that they weren't all just happy and smiley and gold, right? There was that sadness, and that sadness is a part of life, and that's kind of married in there.
Yeah.
And so, and I think that, like, in some ways, and let's not, I don't want to stretch it too far, but the idea of blessedness and happiness, at least from a Psalm 1 perspective, is about kind of the trajectory of a life. Like, a life lived where you never experience sadness is actually quite I don't think that would be a full life. Because there is that counterbalance where those allow kind of the richness of the human experience, which again you see in Jesus, right? If Jesus is in fact the best expression of what it means to be human, which theologically he is. He's the prime example of a human life. He's 100% human. He's 100% divine. And so when we see in Jesus' life the fullness of human, that's our example. And what do you see Jesus often do?
He loved 90s country sad songs.
He loved 90s country. Yeah. Huge fan. But he was often sad.
Yeah.
And he's crying all over the place, right? You think of him with Lazarus. You think of him in the Garden of Gethsemane. I mean, he's constantly entering into that kind of side of it. And so there's something to this happiness, this blessedness, that's far more than like the temporary circumstantial.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, what this psalm's getting at. And it's not something we achieve by direct effort, but it's something of a trajectory of a life. And I think you see that most clearly in Jesus.
So the psalm says, this is what happy people do. I'm paraphrasing. Yeah. They do two things.
Yeah. Well, they don't do three things first, though. It starts with the negative, right? It says, blessed is the one does not walk in step with the wicked or the ungodly, or stand in the way the sinners take, or sit in the company of mockers, which again, I think is this idea of there's a good distinction between, and I wish I'd have brought this out a little more in my sermon, is this isn't a call to a sort of like sectarian faith where we just never interact with a non-believer. Right. And I think that can be read that way, but I think that would be an utter misreading of
this. I'm not hanging out with the wicked.
Yeah, exactly. I can't hang out with that. I have to have only Christian friends. And you can develop a sort of really unhealthy Christian subculture where everything in your life is, quote, Christian, right?
Yeah.
And that is, I think it would be a real misreading of this, because it's not that you shouldn't be around them. But that first phrase, right, who does not walk in step with the wicked or the ungodly, I actually like the older translation of that says does not listen to the counsel of the ungodly. It's not so much that the problem is you're hanging with the ungodly, it's that you're allowing them to give shape to the overall trajectory of your life. Because,
good.
My goodness, we need to be, I mean, that's again, this is Jesus par excellence, right? Like he's with the sinners, he's with the tax collectors, he's with those outside. That was in some ways a very core part of his life. So I wish I'd have brought that out a little bit. I was talking to someone in the courtyard after on Sunday, and they were asking that question. I was like, man, that's a really good question.
Well, this is a little bit about the thing that you talked about during the vision series, where that emergent church movement that came and they said, you know, we're going to go into the bars and we're going to go into the world. And, and they weren't deep enough with God, and instead of shaping the bars and everywhere they went, the bars shaped them.
Bars shaped them, which would be taking the counsel of the ungodly, right?
Yeah.
It's allowing that to shape you, not that you can't be there. But then it gets into the two things that we do.
Yeah, so maybe I wouldn't, if you were going to say, you know, what do happy people do, I might not use the words, we delight in the instruction of the Lord.
Yeah. It's not where most of us would start, I don't think.
So how does that make us happy?
Yeah, I think it's, again, when we contextualize it in the overall course of a life, the general character of the whole of a person's life, to delight in the instruction of the Lord, or the law of the Lord, as the text says, but again, I bridge that word Torah more broadly. Because that's what it means. You know, I'm not just making that up. That's what the word literally means. I think it's because when we come to delight in that, we get to the place where our life will naturally start to take the shape of God's desire for our life. And when you come to delight in that, it means like the challenging difficulty of whatever it is you're facing, whatever it is the instruction of the Lord's calling you to do, the positives outweigh the negatives, right? Like there's a moment where the scale tips and you say, yeah, this is difficult and it's hard, but I'm seeing God working and reshaping my life. Like, I wonder if it's almost akin to like, you know, when you start like going to the gym or whatever for the first time, you're like, I'm going to go work out, I'm going to get in better shape. And at first, you don't delight in it, like at all, right?
You're like, I tried to run a mile, and now I taste blood.
Yeah, exactly. Like, nothing in me is delighting in running that, right? But at some point, when you get in a little better shape, as things start working, it's still hard. It's still, you know, maybe painful at times, and it's still stressful or whatever. But there is a point where you delight in it because you recognize, like, man, the overall shape of my life is like, I don't get out of breath walking upstairs or something, or like whatever it is, like it's feeding into this sort of overall trajectory of your life, and you begin to delight in it, you begin to enjoy it, and so I think that first step is, how do you then delight in the very instruction of God, where Gosh, I was talking to someone else between service who was referencing that old hymn, that beautiful hymn where it's, you know, "and the things of earth grow strangely dim."
Was it Joan?
It was Joan. Did she mention? Shout out to Joan Long. She's so sweet. I love
her. She did that. Well, she mentioned that to me at WBS too. Thanks,
oh, okay.
Thanks, Joan.
Yeah, it's so good. But I love, because when she was mentioning it to me, it was that emphasis on strangely dim, where it's like you delight, you know, in kind of a given state of the world, we delight in those things that don't quite satisfy the imminent frame. We delight in those things, career, money, success, whatever it is. He says, but as we come to delight in the instruction of the Lord, the things of earth grow strangely dim. They don't make sense that they're going dim, but they no longer hold the allure as the way of Jesus does. And he says, that's the trajectory of the happy life, is if we can come to delight in that.
This is back to the whole apprenticeship thing, you know,
exactly.
Like delighting in the instruction of the Lord. This is you following in the footsteps of your rabbi.
Yeah.
And it doesn't say that it's going to be easy, and it you wouldn't necessarily characterize the, you know, disciples or the apostles as happy as they're following him. But yet there is like this contentment and joy and trust that they're aligning themselves with the way that they were always created to live.
Yes.
Yeah. And you can't ignore that, that sense.
Mm-hmm.
The other one I thought was really interesting too. This meditate idea.
Yeah.
Peterson gave a really good perspective on that.
Yeah. Yeah. Which I love. Eugene Peterson, if you have not read him, I always equate him to like the pastor's pastor. And so he's a what I would call like a literary mentor, someone I've just read a ton of his stuff. But he has in his book, As King's Fishers Catch Fire, this section on Psalm 1 that I was referencing a lot in my sermon. And he talks about this word meditate, and he puts this sort of like visceral touch on it. He says, in the language of the psalmist, this word meditate has to do with slow eating, literally to slowly chew or masticate or suck on a lollipop. Meditate is a word our Hebrew ancestors used for reading the kind of writing that deals with our souls. But meditate is far too tame a word for what is being signified. And he'll go on, as I mentioned in the sermon, to talk about the best image he has for it is when you give a dog like a new bone and they just meditate on it. They chew on it. They suck on it. They give their full attention to it.
Yeah.
And I love that there's so much wisdom in this one verse, because this idea of like, how do we come to delight in the instruction of the Lord? Like, you can't just wake up and say, I'm going to delight in it. Right. Like, you can't just like, today's the day I'm going to love it. Like, it just doesn't work that way. It's not a rational decision. And so when then, like, how we come to delight on it is when we meditate on it. You can't think your way into delighting in the instruction of the Lord. You have to meditate your way onto it. That idea of slow chewing, of kind of devoting the fullness of your attention to it. That's when we learn to delight.
I'm about to sneeze.
I tried to wrap up that sentence really quick because I saw the sneeze coming, and I knew you'd have to clip it.
It's going
to
come back. Well, you asked a question, and I was really good with this. I was really good with this concept, Kevin, until you asked this question, and then I didn't like it anymore. You said, "What do you meditate on?"
Yeah.
What are you? Because reality is, we have stuff that we meditate on. We have stuff that we chew on, that we savor, that we slowly leak into our lives on a regular basis.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's not usually God.
Yeah.
It's usually other things.
Yeah. And it's not usually the thing. It's not like we consciously sit down and say, I'm going to meditate on this thing. Like, you know what I mean? Like, and when it happens in those things that are other than God, is that often comes because it's actually the deepest longing of our heart. Right. Like, and think even about like maybe that example of the dog carries on, right? Like, the dog doesn't think, I'm going to go meditate on that bone. It just is overcome by its internal like desire. Like, I'm going to go meditate on that. And so I think we can, this idea of meditate, you know, obviously there is a decision in which we're like, okay, I'm going to shift what I meditate on, and we need to make that. But the default setting is not, we don't meditate on things.
Yeah.
We are meditating on something. We just don't consciously know it yet.
And the case in point is, I asked Katie if I could share this, but you know, another counseling moment. I'm a little bit worried for my life, because Katie, when she's doing dishes or when she's, you know, working out or whatever.
Yeah.
I always find her listening to murder podcasts. And she just loves them. She loves hearing like all the details, not the details of the murders, but like the mystery of it, you know, like the unsolved. I forget which one she likes. She's a couple of them. And I'm like, babe, this is, you're like, you're microdosing on murder podcasts. You're giving yourself a slow trickle. And then one day I'm going to make you mad and you're going to have,
she's going to have the playbook
hours and hours of strategy of how to murder me and get away with it.
Have you guys watched Only Murders in the Building?
She watched it. I did not watch it. That's the one with Steve Martin, right?
Yeah, Steve Martin and Martin Short.
Martin Short, yeah.
And Selena Gomez. Selena Gomez, yeah.
She really liked it. She thought it was pretty funny.
It's literally about a murder and a podcast. So I was like, it's got to be up her alley. Yeah, Lindsay loved that show. So good.
So you go into this thing about like people, well, I'm paraphrasing again, but people are like trees. Psalms makes this connection.
This person is like a tree.
But before you go into that, I want to hear the three things that you kind of pulled out of there. But are you taking a stance on deciduous versus conifer? Like where do you lean, like, on your favorite types of trees?
On my favorite types of trees. I'll be honest, right now I'm scrambling to Google conifers and deciduous.
Yeah, trees that lose their leaves.
Yeah, I am more on, I think, I mean, this time of year, I'm definitely in the evergreen fan club.
They do lose their needles, not all of them.
Yeah, but not like if they're firmly planted, right? Like they're not, you know, it doesn't go bare like a deciduous tree. That's good tree knowledge.
Thanks.
By the way. Oh, yeah. I'm impressed. I grew up in the city of trees, Sacramento. Shout out. That's my tree knowledge.
So Sacramento is...
Isn't it the city of trees?
Is that what Sacramento is, like, something about?
No. No, I don't think so.
It's just their slogan.
I think it's because they have, if I remember right, Sacramento has like the most diverse population of trees in the country or something like that.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Anyway.
It makes sense because if you go,
another thrilling section,
if you go east a little bit, you probably get into the,
yeah,
like the evergreens and
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, where there's not as diverse a selection.
Interesting, yeah.
Is it interesting?
Fallen Sacramento. Sacramento probably comes from like Sacrament, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I would think so. More that. Should we look that up? Curveball. The direction of our podcast. Oh, yeah. But there's this, again, like, and this is where it's so interesting to me that the psalmist chooses this metaphor of trees to say this is what the happy person is like. Of all the things you could choose, right? Like in the first century in the ancient imagination.
And that was before Bob Ross and the happy trees.
Exactly. I should have made a Bob Ross reference. Man, we should have talked last week, man.
I'm telling you.
Jean Mayer, Bob Ross. That'd have been great.
I'm a wealth of illustrations, Kevin. One day you'll realize that.
One
you're
day.
Gonna be listening to all these podcasts when you're like 80 and you'll be like, man, Brandon had a wealth of wisdom that I just untapped.
I just untapped for it. But and so there's this idea again of the happy person being like a tree. I think it conjures this vision of life and vitality, of strength, endurance. I mean, most trees, again, of any substance are really old. Like they've endured through various seasons and epochs and whatnot. And so there's just this kind of vitality to this imagery of trees. And in there, there's three things that, well, outside of kind of the basic essence of this tree is planted by streams of waters, which is an interesting reference again. And the way I pulled that out was like, it's a domestic tree. It's not a wild tree, which when you think of it in the context, which I didn't actually know before going into this sermon, that this was most likely written in during the Babylonian exile, which I found fascinating that like in that moment, they're having this conversation. You know what I mean? When everything seems uncertain, they're like, no, the happy one is still the one that holds, delights and meditates on the instruction of the Lord. That tree is planted by the streams of water. Like they're placed there with an intentionality towards that never ending source of life. Like it's a pretty beautiful image. And then from there, you know, the psalmist says there's three things that the tree does. It yields its fruit in season, its leaf does not wither, and whatever they do prospers. And I think it's, again, it's such a rich kind of thick description, if you will, of the tree. Like, and I loved that idea of when it yields its fruit in season, that means there are seasons when it doesn't yield fruit. There are seasons when it's not supposed to yield fruit.
Yeah.
There's dry seasons. There's stormy seasons. There's fruitful seasons. Like, the tree itself is subject to the ebbs and flow.
It doesn't exempt you from circumstances.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
you're,
yeah,
you're still going to feel the seasons and mm-hmm. the weather of circumstances.
Yeah, which is part, like, when you think about, like, if you've ever been down in, like, Big Sur or, you know, somewhere on the Central Coast where you see these ginormous trees that have endured, like, hundreds of years, right, of, like, living, like, there is something profound about the fact that that tree has stood there for that long.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, we don't think of it often, but I think that is part of what induces awe in us, is what a tree has seen, if you will, kind of, quote, yeah, unquote. And so that gets back to, again, that idea of happiness, according to the psalmist, is not rooted in external circumstances. Because if it is, that means you're void of the different seasons. But the psalmist says, no, this tree, it endures those various seasons. And so that's supposed to, our life will ebb and flow of external circumstances being good and external circumstances being low. And if your sort of, like, base level sign of happiness is rooted in that, man, that's a wild journey. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If there isn't some sort of undergirding of happiness that exists kind of beneath that surface. But then that second one, right, whose leaf doesn't wither, I think that's actually, I feel like, really built on that idea of the seasons, of saying that if the leaf doesn't wither, that means it never gives in to despair. And I'm careful in the way I word that, because I think despair can still happen. That's one of those seasons, potentially, the dark, yeah, night of the soul. But when it doesn't wither, it's saying it doesn't die off because of that. It still kind of exists through those circumstances. So even though it's subject to different seasons, it won't wither. And then lastly, this idea of whatever they do prospers is really, I think, getting at, like, you know, this tree that's lasted, let's just, this metaphoric tree we're talking about, it's lasted for decades through all these storms. It hasn't withered. It's endured. It's prospering. It's doing what a tree should do. It's thriving, even though it's been subject to all that. And so whatever comes its way, it will continue to prosper, but not, again, prosper in a kind of modern American sense of what it means to prosper, but prosper in the way of the Lord, that does endure, that finds its blessedness, its happiness, in the midst of all those seasons.
So I think if you could close with this, I think that there is, you know, we mentioned a little bit throughout this conversation, but that there is a little bit of a myth around happiness and if I just follow God, I'm going to be happy. And you, yeah, mentioned a little bit earlier that, if we're actually in it to find happiness, if that's our,
yeah,
goal,
yeah,
I'm searching for happiness.
Yeah.
That's actually a selfish pursuit, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's not going to yield what we're looking for. And, like,
yeah,
you said, God never promised that we're going to be exempt from experiencing circumstances and hardship and seasons.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
where do you leave people?
Yeah,
that are searching for that.
Yeah, yeah. I think I'd bring back, you know, this is where, if we're going to allow God to reshape our understanding of blessedness and our understanding of happiness, then we have to unlearn that, again, that idea of external happiness being our source of happiness. And I think it gets back, honestly, to that idea of meditating. And I think we have, the reason we think happiness is in externals is because we've meditated on those things, right? We've slowly chewed on them. We've, in a lot of ways, just bought into the myth of happiness being material prosperity.
Yeah.
Because that's what a modern kind of capitalist world needs. It needs consumers. It needs people who have a drive to consume and find happiness in those things. And so it's actually created this myth of happiness that says this is where happiness is found, in the next purchase, the next promotion, the next you know, access to resource and availability. And we've meditated on that. And so naturally we delight in that, right? That's the exact kind of way in which we talked about the psalmist saying the way you find happiness is delighting and meditating on the instruction of the Lord. We are born kind of in a world where we delight and meditate on the instruction of material blessing, or whatnot, or whatever it is we can import from the modern world,
yeah,
the,
yeah,
self, right? And really, it probably does root back to the idea of sort of individualism and the fact that anything outside of the self telling me what to do is actually a transgression on me. Like, it's so fascinating. In a world
that's the only sin.
It's the only sin, yeah. In a world that doesn't believe in sin, the only sin it does believe is when you tell me what to do from an external.
Yeah.
Because we delight and meditate on the self. And so when we get to this idea now in the psalm where it's saying, no, blessed is the one who doesn't seek blessedness, right? Nowhere in scripture does it say, blessed are those who seek blessing.
Yeah.
But, you know, happy are the ones who seek happiness. Because happiness is always a byproduct. It's never something you can achieve by direct effort. Like, I couldn't help, and I actually debated on having a whole section on the Sermon on the Mount here, because Jesus just reframes all of this idea of blessedness or happiness.
Yeah, yeah.
And he flips it on its head. Because, I mean, listen to what, you know, the way Jesus starts his Sermon on the Mount, which is, again, sort of his magnum opus. It's his kind of manifesto of life in the kingdom of God. And he says this, and it's a little long, but he says, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom. I'm going to translate the word blessed, which in Greek is the word makarios, which is also connected to happiness. And so I'm just going to use the word happiness,
okay,
just for the sake of effect. Okay. But happy are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Happy are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Happy are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Happy are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Happy are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Happy are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Happy are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Happy are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And happy are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven. For in the same way they were persecuted, the prophets, they persecuted the prophets who were before you. Like, Jesus in that moment radically redefines the happy one,
mm-hmm,
right? Because as you look at that list, those are all the ones we would think are on the underside.
Associated with, yeah, those are things we run from and try, exactly, to build our lives to avoid.
To avoid, yeah. Mourning. Like, and even like when you get to something like, Dallas Willard has a great section where he talks about those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. The reason they hunger and thirst for it, the reason you hunger for anything is because you don't have it.
Mm.
So he says the reason that the blessed one are that they hunger and thirst for righteousness because they don't have that. They're longing for it. And so this whole list is this kind of inverting of what the world would say is the happy ones. And he says in the kingdom of God, this radically alternative, kind of upside down or maybe right side up, depending on your perspective, he's saying that understanding of the kingdom of God is that those people are actually the happy ones. They're the blessed ones because their life is not rooted in external circumstances. It's connected to something much deeper, which is why then, like so often it says, you know, it frames both verse 3 and verse 10, the quote Beatitudes, frame it by saying theirs is the kingdom of heaven. He says, because the blessed ones, the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And the last one of verse 10, blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. See, blessedness is in the verse I did bring out at the end of my sermon, are for those who seek first the kingdom of God. Everything else will be added. And it doesn't mean you'll get everything you want, but it means everything else is taken care of if we learn to delight and meditate in life in the kingdom of God. He says that's where happiness is found, not in these externals, but in living into the kingdom of God here and now.
You don't always get what you want.
You don't always get what you want.
But... yeah, I was hoping God will. Oh.
It's that God will give you new wants.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah,
I think
that's a Willard statement is where I got it. It's a little kitschy.
I think we can summarize this in the same way that the Heritage Singers did in the 1970s, which is happiness is the Lord. Bum bum